Siding Unlimited, named the best window installers, not just here, but in the whole USA. Get the best. Siding Unlimited, 5-time winner as America's best window installer. For windows you call Siding Unlimited, first and directly, SidingUnlimited.com.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios in downtown Milwaukee, it's Wisconsin's Midday News, making stories come to life. Now, here are your hosts, Greg Matzik and Jessica Tai.
So I mentioned the Bears are favored by 1.5 points for Saturday's game. 24 hours ago, the Packers were favored by 1.5 points.
So exactly.
So here's what happens. So Vegas establishes a line, and the lines are pretty consistent, sometimes about a half point or a variance, maybe a point. And then when people start betting, you know, it can sway where that line goes. So if people see that the Packers were 1.5 point favorites, well, maybe the money started to sway the other way. Now the Bears are 1.5 point favorites. You might see some more money coming back on the Packers. And by the time we get to Saturday, this could be a pick'em game, in which case nobody knows what's going to happen. Really little we know is going to happen. But the betting lines do fluctuate. It's not uncommon to see.
Doesn't get you excited, though. I mean, everybody's talking about it right now. I even look up and I see ESPN, Green Bay Packers at the Chicago Bears Saturday night. It's just fun to talk about. And you see, in fact, we have this coming up in just a couple of minutes here. USA Today just examined all the teams that are left and picked who has the best chances to win the Super Bowl. We'll tell you where the Green Bay Packers come
ooh,
in.
Ooh, like a power ranking of the playoff teams. Interesting.
Indeed.
12:10 here on WTMJ.
It's now at noon on Wisconsin's Midday News.
Today marks 5 years since the January 6 attacks at the U.S. Capitol. During a hearing that's happening right now, House Democrats are reviewing that day and what's happened since. This morning, they heard from 72-year-old Pam Hempel, who 5 years ago was dubbed the MAGA Granny for storming the Capitol. She's a very different person now, though. In fact, she turned down President Trump's pardon. Today, she praised the Capitol Police for helping her in the crush of people around the doors and windows of the Capitol.
But if this was about the Capitol Police officers, there's something in me that I can't allow them to not be recognized and to be lied about for what they did for us on that day. How dare you?
The official plaque honoring the police who defended the U.S. Capitol that day still has not been hung.
Opening statements underway in the criminal trial of a former Uvalde school police officer charged with endangering students during the 2022 school shooting at Robb Elementary.
Prosecutors alleged that former Uvalde school's police officer, Adrian Gonzalez, neglected his duty in 2022 when he failed to confront the shooter at Robb Elementary, despite being one of the first officers to arrive on the scene of the shooting that took the lives of 19 children and two teachers. He's one of two officers to face criminal charges for his role in the botched police response, though nearly 400 members of law enforcement were on the scene that day. He has pleaded not guilty and argues he's being scapegoated. From Corpus Christi, Texas, Peter Haralambos, ABC News.
A jury selection wrapped up on Monday. They found a panel of 12 jurors and four alternates. It was not easy. This took quite a bit of time. Gonzalez faces 29 counts of child abandonment or endangerment. The indictment accuses him of failing to engage the shooter despite being aware of the gunman's location inside the school. The trial actually moved out of Uvalde to Corpus Christi, where Peter's reporting from, after the defense argued their client could not receive a fair trial in Uvalde. If convicted, Gonzalez could face a maximum of 2 years in prison.
All right, we tease this one off the top. What are the chances the Green Bay Packers win the Super Bowl this year? A team at USA Today just examined which contenders are the biggest threat. It ranked all 14 teams that are left, and the results are in. Guess where the Green Bay Packers come in?
All right, so 14 teams in the postseason, right? 7 from the AFC, 7 from the NFC. If I had to guess, I would say the Carolina Panthers are the final team, like the last team,
whoa,
lowest in the power rankings. I would have them at 14. I think I would have the Steelers at 13. I think I would have the Chargers at 12.
Oh, you're doing the whole list.
And I think
look
I would have
you.
The Packers at 11.
The Packers come in at number 12. Yeah, they basically say, in fact, this is the last line of the summary for the Packers. Better luck in 2026,
okay,
fellas.
Well, it's acknowledging that the Packers have a talented roster when healthy, but injuries have certainly slowed them down. Where are the Bears, curiously? I would not have the Bears much higher than the Packers.
So here's the deal. Let me go through a little bit what they say about the Packers. The write-up notes that the Packers enter the postseason as a number 7 seed, meaning they'll need to be road warriors tasked with facing the conference's top seeds if they continue to advance.
Yep.
It also compares this season's Packers team to the battered crew that went 1-and-done in the 2024 postseason. Many of you will remember that. The analysis says Micah Parsons might bring another title to Titletown at some point, but it obviously is not going to be this year. Parsons went down in December, tearing his ACL and knocking him out for the season. Green Bay has not won a game since then. So you pair that with Love getting concussed a couple games ago and the defense disintegrating, and that's why the Green Bay Packers are not listed as a top contender to win the Super Bowl this year. We can always dream, though, and I will. You got to stay positive. You just got to win this game and then win the next game.
That is true. Come on. Look, they were a wild card team the last time they won the championship. And in Jordan Love's first year as a starter, they went on the road as a prohibitive underdog and beat the pants off of the Dallas Cowboys. So it's not as much the Bears. I think the Packers are a better team than the Bears. I really do. It's more about going to Seattle in the second week of the playoffs and trying to beat a 14-3 team in one of the most difficult places to play, and a play the Packers have historically struggled.
Okay, so full disclosure, I had not looked at where the Bears settle because I usually do not care about the Bears.
Okay.
And we're going to beat the Bears.
I'm going to guess they're like 11 or 10.
They're 7. They're 7 on
this list. That's higher than I would put them.
I did look, however. I looked at the Packers, and I looked for who was getting the top spot. They give the best odds of winning the Super Bowl this year to the Seattle Seahawks.
Okay, so that would be the team the Packers would face if they beat the Bears, when they beat the Bears on Saturday night.
Let's speak it into existence.
That's where it gets really tough. 12:15 on WTMJ. I want to check in with Linda Kenyon from CBS. She is covering the story here. Who's in charge of Venezuela? Some contradictory messages coming out of Washington, D.C. We'll go through it after this. Well, Nicolas Maduro and his wife are being held at the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn after his arraignment on Monday in Manhattan, both pleading not guilty to narco-terrorism charges. But questions remain on who exactly is in charge of Venezuela. CBS's Linda Kenyon joining us. Hi, Linda.
Hi there.
So some mixed messages coming from the administration, with President Trump saying the U.S. is in charge. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says the U.S. has no interest in assuming day-to-day governance. I know the groups were meeting today. What is being discussed and what potentially the resolution here?
Yeah, definitely some contradictory statements. The president at first saying the U.S. would run the country, and then trying to say that the, as you say, you know, had no interest in actually running the day-to-day operations. But it does appear that there are some top U.S. officials who are going to be running the day-to-day operations. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, for example, Vice President Vance, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, White House Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller, Energy Secretary Chris Wright. They're all involved in trying to get the country to, I don't know, should we put it, fall in line, if you will. And until such time, the president says that there can be elections that would be fair and judicious. But for now, the vice president, Delcy Rodriguez of Venezuela, is now the acting president. She has tried to reach out. She's kind of in a sticky spot, as you can imagine. One, trying to maintain the loyalism to the Maduro government, with which she is now the head, or also trying not to anger the United States in any way so as to have herself deposed. So it's a very fluid situation right now. More questions than answers.
President Trump today, he called the operation brilliant and complex. And I feel like the majority of people would say we're not surprised to hear the president, President Trump, saying this was brilliant and they did it the best. I'm curious, do we know of anything that went wrong? And if anything did go wrong in the midst of this, would we hear about it?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Would we hear about it? What we have heard is that there were no American casualties. There were two American service members, I believe two, who were injured, but they are not considered to be life-threatening injuries. We do know that there were 55 Venezuelan and Cuban military personnel who were killed. Now, those Cubans, about 32 of them, were assigned as security personnel for guarding Maduro and his wife. They were not, by the way, in a safe room behind a steel door. They could have been, but for some reason they were not, and so it was much easier to get to them. The American military forces that did capture him and his wife did come armed with blowtorches and other tools in order to break down a possibility of a metal door leading to a safe room. They did not need to do that. Again, we have heard of no serious American casualties, just Cuban and Venezuelan.
Linda, how are both sides of the aisle reacting to the intervention and takeover? It certainly would not surprise me that Republicans would say, we did it, we did a great job, exactly as planned, while Democrats might say, this wasn't even legal. What are we doing here? But I'm very curious if there are Republicans who look at this and say, wait, what did we just do? Why did we do that? This is the wrong move. Or conversely, Democrats who look at this and saying, yeah, no, this was warranted. This is something that should have been done maybe long ago.
Well, I will say that like most things in Washington and in the country, which Washington does reflect, the members of Congress reflect the country, things do tend to split along party lines. Sharply along party lines. But there is some wiggle room in this situation. For example, a lot of conservative Republicans who are very strong Trump supporters and members of the MAGA movement have been very concerned about this, saying that it is not the America First agenda that they signed up to, that they signed on to. As you recall, Georgia Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene is now the former Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene. Her last day was yesterday. She resigned. She had announced it before this Venezuela raid, but she said it was because of the policies of Trump were no longer her policies, that he had promised to be an America First president, and she felt that many of his policies were the opposite of America First. So we're seeing some cracks within the strong party alliances, certainly on the Republican side of the aisle. Some Democrats, and I should say probably everybody, does agree that that Maduro did not represent what they wanted to be running Venezuela, and that they didn't like him in office. But it's always a question of when and how, and in this case, more how, in terms of how he was removed. And again, those questions of legality. And then where does it stop? A lot of other nations are looking at this. Cuba, for example, Mexico, for example, saying, well, if the United States could do that in Venezuela, what's to stop him from doing it in other countries?
I wonder, too, what is it like in Venezuela right now on the ground? I know President Trump said we have to nurse the country back to health before the new elections come.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of the Cuban, pardon me, the Venezuelan people have been celebrating the end of the Maduro regime, although it's not really the end of the Maduro regime with the acting president in place and most of the government still there. The people in Venezuela have lived under very poor conditions for decades, and so you would imagine that a huge number of them, living in poverty, for example, more than 90%, are welcoming a change. However, again, it's a question of how this was done and whether the U.S. Is allowed to take over another sovereign nation.
You bring up Delcy Rodriguez being sworn in. I do wonder, Linda, if she just becomes a puppet expected to act out the wishes of the United States, or if she's able to operate as, you know, the acting president now of the country.
Well, the president of the United States has said he's willing to work with Rodriguez as long as she submits to his demands when it comes to providing U.S. companies, oil companies, for example, access to Venezuela's massive oil reserves, bringing up the long question, which is, was this about drugs or was this about oil? That question has been lingering for quite some time, long before this raid that happened over the weekend. So she's in a very difficult spot. She has to still project that she is the leader of Venezuela, of the Maduro regime, and at the same time not anger the United States. It's a tightrope.
Great information from Linda Kenyon of CBS. CBS's Linda Kenyon, thank you so much.
Thanks, Linda.
Thank you. Thank you.
The new year brings a new incentive for movie makers to choose Wisconsin. The Badger State has a film office again and just launched a $5 million tax incentive program to attract more productions to the state. It is incredibly meaningful for one Wisconsin filmmaker. Nathan Deming is the founder of Nobody Pictures, based in Eau Claire in Los Angeles. He's actually on the Warner Brothers lot right now, putting the finishing touches on his next film, and he joins us live on the phone. Thanks for taking time out for us.
Hi, Jessica. Nice to meet you.
You testified last year in an effort to make this happen, to have the state reestablish a film office and create tax credits to attract filmmakers to the state. How much does this mean to you now that it's actually happening? The time is now.
This is super exciting, and it wasn't just me. This whole thing happened because of Action Wisconsin and a coalition of filmmakers and more than filmmakers across the state, just people who are interested in bringing more filmmaking here. And yeah, I think we were all kind of stunned when it passed. I mean, I know that just in my own personal film journey, when I finished film school about 12 years ago, I wanted to live and work in Wisconsin, and I just couldn't because of, first of all, there's no film office. Second of all, there's no film incentives. Those are kind of like the basic needs of infrastructure that any state needs to kind of build a film industry. So this is really exciting.
Yeah, State Senator Julian Bradley, also on the ground floor, instrumental in getting this done. So the film office provides a single point of contact. It also helps manage the incentives. Nathan, do you know who that point of contact is? Have you been in touch with those people? Is it really the clearinghouse for everything that makes it advantageous for you to shoot a film or a commercial or anything like that in the state of Wisconsin?
Yeah, the film office is super important for filmmakers and for Hollywood and just for regular people, because it's like the first place Hollywood can call if they want to film in Wisconsin. It's also a place for filmmakers like myself to find each other. As of this moment, I believe they've hired somebody. They just haven't announced it yet. So hopefully any day now we'll find out who that person is.
I'm curious, how does a $5 million incentive program to compare to what other states are offering? Not every state has a program, but a lot of them do at this point. How does ours compare?
Yeah, it might be good to explain what it is, because I found people in the film industry don't even understand what these incentive programs are. But they're like changing the landscape of how movies are made. So basically, countries or states or even cities can offer these incentives where basically, if you come and film here, we'll give you 20 to 30% of your budget back. And it's a win-win for everybody, because the community has a film coming in, spending money, and then the film gets to save some money, right? So Wisconsin's is a transferable tax credit that's 30% back, which is really competitive. And the pool we're starting with is $5 million, which is a bit small, but also really smart because we're just starting the program. Minnesota's is about $25 million. So we got to get there, but we got to show demand for it first and, you know, just make sure that the whole thing's working properly. But no, I think it's a great start for hopefully what will be a successful program.
So, Nathan, credits cover feature films, they cover TV series, documentaries, and commercials. Let's say you are making a feature film, and 30% of that filming takes place in Wisconsin, and then 30% takes place in Minnesota, and the rest maybe in Michigan. Do the tax credits sort of move with you? Do you take advantage of each state's opportunities and just for the percentage or portion that's filmed in that particular state? How does that work?
Yeah, like for a filmmaker, you can easily just go to multiple states. If your story is all over, you can go and take, you know, if you film in New Mexico, which has a really good credit program, you can take part of theirs, and if you film in Wisconsin. But as far as like the state program goes, the only thing that Wisconsin's going to reimburse the production for is anything spent on Wisconsin. Does that make sense? So only Wisconsin crew members, only Wisconsin vendors. That way, we can avoid what happened about 20 years ago. We had this program. We were actually way ahead of the curve before other states were adopting this. We tried it out, and we got a little burned because I think we were too ahead of the curve. A movie called Public Enemies got some flack at the time for supposedly not earning as much money for the state as was spent. So since then, states have really figured out how to put the guardrails in place to make sure that you're not just flying in crew from California or even our neighboring states and then getting tax dollars from Wisconsinites basically to incentivize that. This is all to make sure that the money is spent in Wisconsin and stays in Wisconsin.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's smart. We're talking with Nathan Deming, the founder of Nobody Pictures, based in Eau Claire in Los Angeles, about the Badger State now having this film office again and just launching a $5 million tax incentive program to attract more productions to the state. So we're now on a more level playing field to attract filmmakers. What does Wisconsin offer that other states can't? And maybe it's in our landscape. Maybe it's in the people. What do you think as a filmmaker?
I think we're a very artistic state, even though we're 48th out of 50th or something for arts funding. But there's something about our culture, our climate, that produces a lot of artists. There's actually like a lot of working actors and directors right now that are super famous, that are right from Wisconsin, Mark Ruffalo, Willem Dafoe. You know, I think we've produced a lot of people. I think also behind the camera, we have like a lot of, you know, our Midwest work ethic is pretty famous out in Hollywood. But also just the state itself, you can kind of cover a lot of locations more than you think. I mean, the lakes can easily be oceans. Any urban part of Milwaukee, or even where I'm partly based, Eau Claire, can double for pretty much any city in the world now. And then all you have to do is drive 15 minutes and suddenly you got that classic Wisconsin heartland imagery, cornfields and farms and all that stuff too. I think it's a beautiful state, and I think most importantly, we're pretty underrepresented on the screen. So I think there's Hollywood's always looking for new stuff. I say, come to Wisconsin, see what we got.
So Nathan, you created a film called February, and this was an award winner at the Wisconsin Film Festival in 2024. And it was about an immigrant, small town, rural guy ends up, out of the country, ends up in Wisconsin, and falls in love with ice fishing. There's a brief synopsis. Did you film that in the state of Wisconsin, or because of the tax credit situation at that time, did you film it somewhere else? But the story was, you know, based upon this love affair with a time honored tradition in the state of Wisconsin.
No, that's a part of this series I'm doing. I'm going to make a film for every month of the year, all set in Wisconsin. Those will all be shot in Wisconsin. So that was filmed between Toma, which is my hometown, go Toma, and Eau Claire. So, yeah, no, it was really fun to shoot here. Yeah, the tax incentives weren't around at the time, but it was just sort of a no-brainer. I mean, it's about ice fishing. Where am I going to find that in California, you know?
Nathan, you're on the set of Warner Brothers right now. That's where you called us from, so I love it. Can you give us the visual? Tell us what it's like and what you're up to.
Sure. Well, right now I'm in a dark mixing room underground. But, yeah, we're mixing my new film called Winter Hymns, which I'm really excited. This came together kind of strangely off the back. A lot of the film tax incentive advocacy last year, I just met a million amazing Wisconsin filmmakers and actors. It's about a palliative care physician taking care of dying patients as they reflect on their lives. So it's going to come out pretty soon. Can't say when or where yet, but really excited to wrap it up. And I like so excited that Warner Brothers, I guess they, once in a while, they like to support young filmmakers. So just really honored and excited to be here.
Yeah, that's awesome. Real quick, speaking of young filmmakers, I'm curious if you think this new step here in Wisconsin will keep young creatives from leaving the state, and how quickly maybe some other movies could come because filmmakers around the country know, hey, we can go to Wisconsin and get some money to shoot there now.
Yeah, that's a huge part of it. I didn't want the next generation to kind of go through what I went through, and then other people I've talked to my age or older went through, which is just that there wasn't the right things in place to make sure you could make a living in Wisconsin. So we train about 500 graduates every year in film and TV, and most of them have to leave the state right now. So hopefully that changes. And yeah, I mean, I'm excited. What I specifically got to talk to the Wisconsin Congress about when I testified was just the message that culture matters. And like, once we get to tell our own stories, like, you don't know what's going to happen. I mean, there's hit TV shows all the time, like Yellowstone, that suddenly drive tourism to that state. Nobody thought that'd be a huge hit. And now people, I think Montana saw some increase in 1 million visitors per year just because of that hit TV show. So who knows what's waiting? Maybe somebody will make a hit TV show about Appleton, and then everybody will want to go to Appleton or something like that.
Well, I like that idea. And we just saw success last year with Green and Gold that was shot here. And the directors, I mean, the team of brothers, they had the opportunity to have it shot elsewhere and to get a lot of money and to sell it. And they said, no, we've got to keep that movie here in Wisconsin. And it ended up being a great success.
Totally. That's such a good example of this, right? Because it's called Green and Gold. It's about the Packers. And they almost shot it in Illinois. That would have been like so sacrilege, you know?
In so many ways.
So many ways. Well, thank you so much, Nathan. We appreciate your time. We'll let you get back to doing your mixing work, putting the final touches on your new film on the set of Warner Brothers. We appreciate your time today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. Nice to meet you guys both.
That's Nathan Deming, founder of Nobody Pictures, which is based partially in Eau Claire and partially in L.A. We're coming up on 1250 here in Wisconsin's Midday News. Up next, toddler teachings. What is fake news 101? With AI making it harder than ever to tell what's real online, students overseas are learning how to spot fake news. And at a very young age, we're talking about toddlers learning about fake news. CBS News correspondent Tina Kraus has the details.
At this elementary school in Finland, there's one goal in the classroom, separating fact from fiction.
Is it fake or real?
Finnish kids start learning about media and the internet in preschool. By fourth grade, spotting lies is part of the lesson.
We've been studying about how to recognize if a picture or a video is made by AI.
Teachers say the stakes are higher than ever as Finland borders Russia, which is accused of misinformation campaigns across Europe since the invasion of Ukraine and Finland joined NATO.
Initially, it was only thought as a basic civic skill that you need to understand media. But now it becomes really a way of trying to protect our democracies.
And experts say the information landscape will only get trickier.
Right now, it's reasonably easy to spot the AI-generated fakes because the quality of them isn't as good as it could be. But as that technology develops, I think that's when it could become much more difficult for us to spot.
With kids getting most of their news online, educators say if the fight against fake news starts early, it could become a lesson for life. Tina Kraus, CBS News, London.
So I actually love the idea of this, but it boggles my mind that kids as young as three are learning this. Because I'm like, aren't the kids still trying to learn how to put full sentences together
well,
at three?
Yes. I mean, at three, you're understanding that words go from left to right if you're reading them and maybe understanding
yes.
what certain shapes are. Can you count to 20, right? The sort of your basic math and cognitive skills, language and literacy. But kids are also spending more time at that age in front of screens. And a lot of learning happens on that screen, that tablet, that little math game, or put the shape here, or color this red. That's more and more popular than it's ever been. So it really more fits into the world of social and emotional growth and I guess some level of cognitive development. But it's really fascinating, and I would argue that adults could use this too. Maybe a little refresher.
Well, and that's the thing. The other thing is, think about back to when we were kids in school. I mean, the phrase fake news, it
didn't exist.
It didn't exist.
Well,
it
online
didn't
exist.
And the thing is, and oh gosh, when people first started saying it, it would just kill me. I was like, oh geez. And I hated it too, being in local media, because I always say local media is so different than if you turn on the national outlets.
Sure.
It's just a different ballgame. And when you're talking about actual reporters on the ground in your neighborhood versus people who are on the air and who are giving their opinions and all that, it's just different. So the whole fake news, the phrase of it just made me insane initially. I've gotten more used to it now, and obviously it's just become part of our culture. So I think this is great. It just boggles my mind that kids as young as three are dealing with this. But hey, start young. And Greg, you mentioned adults could use this. Well, adults can take courses too, especially seniors who may be more vulnerable to false information.
Yeah.
So they've got a good idea going over there in Finland. And yeah, we're going to talk more about this coming up in a couple hours. We'll give you a little bit of time, but we'll dive a little bit deeper into
it. Yeah, I'm wondering, I've got an example here. I'm wondering if a three-year-old or even some adults could spot the difference in a deep fake. That's become a big
some
thing
Some of them
here
are tricky. Some of them are so easy. You look at it and you're like, oh gosh, that's fake. Other ones, you really have to pay attention.